we're now at step five. We're going to talk about step five, but I'm hoping, and I know that I've said this several times since I've been up here in Anchorage, that one of the things that is my objective for coming is to demystify the most two misunderstood steps, three and four. That three is a decision. And any decision that is not immediately followed by action means nothing. The three frogs are sitting on a log. One of the frogs decides to jump from the log. How many frogs are on the log? Three. Because a mere decision to hop off the log yields the frogs nothing. You have to finally get your rump off the log and jump in the water to effect that decision. And when I decided to come here to Anchorage, nothing happened until I got on the airplane. Nothing happened until I came here. So a decision must be followed by action. Page 72. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger, on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part. There's that word again. which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. What this looks like in your head and what this looks like in my head is two different things. I need that input of what you are thinking when I tell you these various things that led to my resentments, my fears, and my sexual harms done to other people. I need to let these things see the light of day. And it's not okay just admitting them to myself, because a broken brain cannot fix a broken brain. And I've spent my life justifying these things, and I've spent my life sweeping these things under the rug. It's time to let God have them. Okay? Many of us thought... many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Do you need more evidence than that you must do this? Do you need more evidence that if you skip this step, you may not be able to avoid compulsively overeating? Do you still need convincing? Because if you do, I would think you'd need to go back to the beginning and start again. Okay? The best reason first. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory, all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. And we got very confused when it said we told someone else all our life story. And in OA, we have gone through changes in OA over the years. And when we were in OA, or I was in OA in 1979, 80, 81, we did autobiographies because it said we told someone else all our life story. Well, we didn't want to do an inventory, so we were writing autobiographies. And I remember going to Greenbrier Park on Peterson Avenue Avenue in Chicago, telling some poor, sick, compulsive overeater the story of my life. The fact that I graduated Mather High School in 1972 is a part of my story. It's probably not much a part of why I'm a compulsive overeater or anything else, but it's just part of my story. And the fact that I lived at 6309 North Albany is part of my story. Doesn't mean anything in my compulsive overeating, but if we do the inventory, that is my life story. If you sponsor me and I give you my inventory and I do 10-step calls with you all the time, you're going to know more about me than anybody. You're going to know what I'm thinking, what I'm fearing, what I'm resenting, where I'm selfish, where I'm self-seeking, where I'm dishonest. All these various things are going to come to the surface. We don't need to do autobiographies. So I threw it in the trash when we were done, and all I ended up doing was burning paper and some time in my life that I'll never get back. But other than that, I really accomplished nothing. Okay. It wasn't because I was misled. It was because that's what we were told to do. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes. He vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. Why? Why does more fear and tension make more drinking? Because if I'm in fear and I'm not inventorying that fear and I'm not turning it over through the inventory process, the fear is going to tickle my mental twist. The mental twist is going to activate. The mental twist is going to drive me into the food, convincing me, because I can't tell the true from the false, it's going to convince me that this time I'm just going to eat 3 or 4 Oreo cookies and leave the rest. I eat the first Oreo cookie, I get about 8 seconds worth of the effect, but along with that comes the physical allergy. The physical allergy takes over, I have craving beyond human aid. Now I am now in the cookies up to my ears. I've eaten every cookie that isn't nailed down, and then I'm cleaning out the refrigerator. I'm passing through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat cookies again or eat turkeys again or eat pizza again. I make that resolution. I pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat that way again, and I will repeat that cycle over and over and over and over again. The mind telling me it's okay and the body ensuring that it's not. Now that may be the 1 millionth time I've said that since I landed in Anchorage, but this is exactly how the illness kills you. You don't wake up in the morning and say, okay, today I'm going to eat ice cream. Most relapse begins 120 days before the food goes in the mouth. You stop doing 10 steps. You stop inventorying the fear. You stop inventorying the resentments, and you're stuffing them, and you're stuffing them, and you're stuffing them, and you've got a lumpy carpet now. You're stuffing them under the carpet. You are now operating on self-will. You have made a decision to stuff anger, to stuff fear, to stuff these various selfishnesses and dishonesties. You have made a decision to play God. You're not inventorying these things. You are living in fear. You are living in resentment. Based on that, you're operating on self-will. Based on self-will, you are no longer in recovery. You are on a
diet.
Thank you. You are on a diet. Once you're on a diet, you're going to eat again. It's just a matter of when. And this repetition of the dieting, going into the mental twist, driving you into the food, triggering the physical allergy, the allergy making it impossible for you to stop, passing through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat that way again, and repeating that cycle over and over and over and over and over again is something that you have done for a long, long time. How do I know that? You wouldn't be sitting here if you didn't. Would you? But this is the monotonous repetition of the illness, and that's why when I do one of these, and you heard me on tape or you heard me on the podcast, I repeat this a million times. You're going to be hearing it again. You're going to be hearing it today. You're going to be hearing it tomorrow. I'm not going to stop doing that because this is exactly the mechanism that the illness uses to kill you. This is the nature of what this is. And as we get older, we lose that ability to burn the food as efficiently. And as we get older, our ability to move around and burn the food becomes less and less. The pancreas that secretes insulin, which digests sugar, and the gallbladder and the liver, which secrete bile, which digests fat, as we get older, become more and more efficient? No, less and less efficient. And the enzymes that we're releasing to digest the food become less and less efficient. The destruction of the food becomes worse and worse. The cravings become harder and harder. The destructive nature of the food becomes more and more lethal. And as we get older, our ability to move around, our ability to exercise it off, and the furnace that we are using to burn it become less and less efficient. The resentments become more and more deep-seated. The fears become more and more deep-seated, driving us into the food, and eventually, we're dead. But on the way to the grave, this illness likes to degradate you and amputate your leg or legs and play with you a little bit more. Maybe we'll give this one dialysis. Wait till you see what I do with that shunt. Wait till you see the amputations, the stents in the heart valve, the pacemakers, the destructive forces of the diabetes. Haven't been there yet with a relative? You'll get there with friends. Haven't been there with anybody? You will. Stick around. We've buried many people in Chicago and in Phoenix and some in Los Angeles and other people that I know that are no longer with us. My dear friend Sherry, my wonderful friend Sherry B., what a genius. She had advanced psychology degrees from the University of Chicago and the University of Michigan. She was a therapist's therapist. And she died at age 53 at 400 pounds because she would not put the food down until the forensic analysis of why she was eating came back from the lab. She was going to analyze why she was eating, and she's dead. My mother died from this disease. Maybe you've lost a parent. Maybe you've lost a child. Maybe you've lost a loved one, or maybe you haven't. But the saddest words of tongue or pen are these few words: it might have been. What about you? Have you given enough time to this illness? Have you given enough decades? Maybe it's going to take another 10 years for you to recover. Maybe you're just not ready. Maybe you're going to go out there and you're going to hunker down on unaided willpower against the onslaught of this food so that others around you will do the crying and they'll watch you get amputated and they'll watch you get a stent in your heart. My friend is an international accountant. He's the most wonderful person God ever put on this earth. But he's 375 pounds. He's about 5'7", 5'8". He can't even walk. He can't get in and out of a car. He's got two stents in his heart. He's a diabetic. Things are not looking good in his life. There is not one problem in my life today. where working less steps and eating more food and being more angry and being more scared is going to improve that situation. I hope I broke it down as simply as I could. That this is how it kills you, and that their solution is so simple and so easy that in our zeal to overcomplicate things, we try to take two and two and make it into something that it's not. This is not complicated. You sit down with somebody and you give them your fifth step. Trust me when I tell you, I've listened to more fifth steps than many people, and not as many as others. There is nothing I have not heard. Nothing. There's nothing new under the sun. Unless you are a Martian, or maybe you're a cyborg or something, there is nothing I have not heard. Nothing. You sit down with somebody, you give them your step, it takes a day, you sit down with them, and then you're ready to go home for the hour. We'll get to that in a minute, and then you do 6 and 7, and then we'll be ready to do 8 and 9. But let's keep going. These memories are... Thank you. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery. We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must and of course will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. If we cannot or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintance for a closed-mouth, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It may be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand, yet be unaffected. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. In other words, you don't have the right to do your fifth step with, say, Sam, who's the brother of Mike, and you were married to Mike and have 20 resentments against Mike. You don't have the right to dump that on him. You don't have the right to give this information to someone that you know is going to be affected. So you consider that carefully. Okay. Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one who is so situated that there's no suitable person available. If that is so, this step may be postponed only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. This is important, that we be able to keep a confidence that he fully understands and approves what we are driving at, that he will not try to change our plan, but we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have written inventory and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. We should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone in perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. It doesn't say we go back to work. It doesn't say we go back to whatever. Be quiet for an hour. My God, the world will get along without you for 1 hour. Do what it says. Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. Now, when we do step 7 prayer, you're welcome to join me, but let's remember that step 7 is the very first step where we're going to take this program out of the laboratory, out of the safety net of just the fellowship and the book. Now, I have to start practicing these principles, these steps, in all of my affairs. So it's one thing to practice this with you, but now, can I operate my business in total honesty? Can I operate my marriage in total honesty? Can I operate my life without fear and selfishness and self-seeking? And can I do that knowing that I have an inventory process, but can I go forward in my life knowing that if I'm going to gossip about you, that it's leading me to the food? Now remember something. Everything I do today, from the way I look at you, from the way I speak to you, from the way I correct my dog, my other dog died Tuesday, from the way I do these various things, I'm either going toward God or I'm going toward food, and there's no middle ground. From the way I put on my pants, from the way I speak to people, from the way I greet you in the morning, I'm either moving toward God or I'm moving toward the food, and there's no middle ground. I am a body in motion. There's no park, there's no neutral, there's no low. God, food. God, food. In everything I do. And if I'm going to live a life in the steps, can I operate in my life at home with lying, selfishness, self-seeking, and fear? No. No. I have to be ready to trust God in all things unilaterally. Because if I'm not willing to do that, anything I place before God, I will lose. If I put my business before God, I'll lose my business. If I put girls before God, I'll lose girls. If I put money before God, I'll lose money. Anything I place before God, I will lose. What is God? God is the thing I work toward all day, the thing I put the most thought and effort in. If I say some prayers in the morning and then think all day about making money, money is my God. If I say some prayers in the morning and say some prayers at night and all day long I'm chasing after women, women are my God. It's the thing I put the most effort and thought into. And I must say that at this point in my life, I'm lucky enough so that the thing that I think the most about is service to OA and God. But that takes a long time and a lot of work. I mean, a lot of thinking and sitting. No, a lot of work, sorry. It takes a lot of work. And this is not a program for people who need it. It's not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. It's a program of action. There is no chapter into sitting around thinking while you're watching television. That's not one of the chapters. But there is a chapter that says into action. Into action. Okay. When we do the seven-step prayer, if you care to join me, you are free to join me. If you don't want to join me, you are free not to. We'll love you anyway. It's really okay. But I love the seven-step prayer, and there's prayers all over, but I love this one. Okay. When we were ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. Sounds simple, but if you've done the first 6 steps, it's pretty much just an automatic progression. If you just looked at steps 6 and 7 by themselves without having done the work, you think, well, this is easy peasy. But it's a progression of steps. Now we need more thinking without, I mean more action, sorry. Now we need more action without which we find that faith without works is dead. That's the second time that we're seeing faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we had harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. That's a reference to step 0 on page 58 where it says we're willing to go to any lengths. Okay. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Remember, we talked about that in Bill's story. They told Bill that he needed to be maximum, and they told him to go recruit stockbrokers. And he said, no, I'm going to sober up drunks. This is why I was born. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God when it will serve any good purpose. We are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though he may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the results. Now, in 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. Most alcoholics owe money. There's the understatement of the year. We do not dodge our creditors, telling them what we are trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know about it anyway, whether we think so or not. Now, the only ones that don't get it are us, especially with compulsive overeating. They see the body. They see, you know, we don't want them to. We don't think they should or could, but they see it. Okay. Help. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing, but maybe we're divorced and have remarried, but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She is indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding, reminding ourselves we've decided to go to any lengths. Here's that reference again, okay? Any lengths, excuse me, where am I now? Wait a minute. Oh, to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Now, I'm going to talk for just a few minutes here about some of my amends. My amends were financial amends mostly. I wrote a lot of bad checks when I was eating. I wrote a lot of bad checks to people that had been doing business with my father for decades. I wrote a lot of bad checks. I wrote bad checks on my dead mother's bank account. I wrote bad checks on my dead father's bank account. I did a lot of lying in my illness, and I had to go back and pay those people back. Now, some of those people that I owed money to, they ripped up the bills. My father was a sausage peddler, one of the sausage companies in Chicago, Sinai 48. I went to the guy to pay him back thousands of dollars that I didn't have, but I was trying to arrange payment. He looked me square in the eye, and he took the bill, and it was for thousands of dollars, and he tore it to shreds, and he said, all I wanted you to do was to be a mensch and come in here and face me on this. You don't owe me anything. I loved your dad. I'm writing this off. It's no big deal. It's done. I want you to go out there and honor your father and live your life. I don't want a penny from you, and he wouldn't take my money. There were other people that did, and that's fine. And most of the time, I was unable to pay them back in one hunk. I was not able to pay them back in one payment. I had to pay them out. One of the things that happened to me, and it is going to happen to you, is that God is going to send you help in the most unexpected ways, from the most unexpected directions, when you least expect it but need it the most. There's a mouthful. One of the things that happened to me was I didn't pay my taxes for years, and the government came in to where I was working, and they served me with a notice that if I didn't pay, they were going to start garnishing and they were going to take my bank account and so on and so forth. Bob Berman, who was the guy that I was working for at the time, loaned me interest-free thousands and thousands of dollars to pay the feds and the state of Illinois so that I could avoid interest and penalties. He was my boss. He wasn't my relative. He wasn't my friend. He was my boss. He loaned me money interest-free to the tune of thousands of dollars, and then he really helped me. He put me in touch with his friend Sonny Goodman. And Sonny Goodman had been an attorney in Chicago. He lived in the Hancock Building. He put me in touch with Sonny Goodman. My credit was ruined. I had owed the government money, and there is nothing more devastating on a credit report than a tax lien. They figure if you won't pay your taxes, God bless you, you're not paying anything to anybody. And so what he did was he spent hundreds of hours that he would normally bill out at hundreds of dollars per hour repairing my credit and making settlements with creditors that I didn't know personally. He did this free of charge to me because he was Bob's friend and I was Bob's employee, and I will always be indebted to him. There were other kinds of amends that I needed to make that had nothing to do with money, and there were two people in particular that I had hurt tremendously. One was my mother and one was my father. I did not do anything that didn't hurt my mother. I did everything I could to hurt my mother. I blamed my mother for everything. She was the bane of my existence. She was fat, I wanted her to be thin. She was old, I wanted her to be young. I wanted Rob and Laura Petrie. I got Max and Virginia Grabowski. I had two parents that were the biggest disappointments of my life, and I was angry at them, and I was angry at God, and every time I felt pain, every time I cried, every time I felt that disappointment, I hated my mother more and more and more and more and more, because I was sure that if I would have had different parents, if I would have lived in your house, if I would have had your bike, if I would have had a family like you, if I would have had what you have, if I was anybody but me, if I was anybody but their son, I would be free of this intense pain and this intense wanting, and I blamed her for everything. And then she died. And I still blamed her. And I ate railroad cars of Doritos. And I ate thousands of candy bars, and I ate mountains of Raisinets, and I blamed her for everything that went wrong in my life, and I came into this program, and they told me I had to forgive, and they told me I had to forget, and you don't understand, it's not fair. Why should I forgive them? My mother was mentally ill. Why should I forgive that? It's not fair. Look what she did to me. She was mentally ill. My father barely spoke English. My father had all kinds of shortcomings, and I blamed him too, although not nearly as much. And I had to get in touch with something, and it took me 10 years in program to get in touch with this undeniable fact. And the first breakthrough came about 10 years in, and the first breakthrough was I didn't choose them. That they were wonderful, generous people, but but I didn't choose them, and it started to be okay. I could start to live with some of it. And then something else happened on December the 14th, 1994, at 4:27 in the afternoon in Eugene, Oregon, at Sacred Heart Hospital. My mamala was born. Hannah Leah Grabowski was born, and she looked like a little pumpkin. She was orange. And they told us that because my wife had had such vomiting and such illness, and she had to ingest a lot of drugs, and she had all kinds of hyperemesis and all kinds of this, they didn't know what was going to happen to my daughter, and they called us in and they said there's a possibility that she'll have CP and that she baby may be blind and deaf. Oh, and developmentally delayed. Oh, and she'll be a White Sox fan too. I mean, is there any, I mean, you got anything else in there? I mean, you want to give her anything else? And we're 3,000 miles from home in Eugene, Oregon. Bay is mayor. And look around, and there, I mean, nobody in Oregon cared whether we lived or died. I mean, really, not when you get to it. So she's born, and my wife is sick, and my daughter is orange, and they said it does not appear that baby is blind. The nurse's name was Janice. I can see her now. She says it does not appear baby is blind. I walked that little mamala, I walked that little ketzela into the ICU at Sacred Heart, the NICU at Sacred Heart Hospital. And they said, are you okay to walk her? I said, absolutely, I'm okay, I'm fine. I walked her into the neonatal intensive care unit, and they started hooking her up to different monitors, and they put needles in her foot. They is mere her poor little foot. And she's got the needles and the fuss and oy, 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 and she's got all kinds of things going on, and she's in there, and it took about 5 minutes, and bam! I said, oh, God, Mom, I know how much I hurt you now. I'm sorry. Oh, my God, it just came to me in an epiphany from watching my child how helpless my mother was over my extreme disappointment at her. That she loved me. That if she could have given me Laura Petrie, she would have given me Laura Petrie. If my father could have given me Rob Petrie, he would have given me Rob Petrie. That they would have denied me nothing. They were kind, loving people. They were, everybody loved my parents except me. Everybody loved them. Everybody thought, Mrs. G, Mr. G, they're the great. That's what they called my dad. Mr. G, they called my mom. My last name is Grabowski. My mother was Mrs. G. My father was Mr. G. The only one that didn't like them was me, because they weren't able to solve my pain. They weren't able to fit the missing piece into my gedarum. Gedarum is here. Gedarum is here. Gedarum is your guts. They couldn't fit some piece into my heart, into my life, that would have made me free of the pain. But when I saw my baby, when I saw my child, when I saw that baby in the isolette, isolette at Sacred Heart Hospital, it just hit me like the John Hancock building fell on my head. and I could understand that I loved them, and I stopped thinking about how I was screwed by them, and I started thinking about what I could do for them, even though they were dead and still are, because now I started thinking about them in the terms of their loss. What did my dad do? What was his crime? My God, look at the price the man paid for his life so that I could be born. My mother had mental illness. I didn't choose it, and she didn't choose it. So I was able to come to a forgiving, loving direction with her, and it emancipated me. What did they want most of all? What was their dream? What was their goal? That I would live free of the food, that I would live free of their nightmares, that I would live free of the insanity and the bedlam that was hurting me. I was the reason that they got together. I was the reason that my father survived. He never asked why these people were killed. He said, why didn't you kill me too? But he knew that he was born, or he survived, so I would be born in this country. You talk about a moose or a bear. If he would see a squirrel or a pigeon, he would shake his head. He always wore a hat. He would take his hat. He always smoked a cigarette. He'd say, what a country, what a country, what a country. And I'd say, Pod, what's going on? He'd say, a pigeon. He called it a chicken, whatever it is. He'd say, give a cook. It would mean give it a look. And he would say, give it a look. He'd say, what a country this is. And I'd say, what has that got? There was a squirrel or a rabbit. And he would laugh and he would say, do you realize what a country you're in? Because if this was the old country when we were on the run, running through the forest, we could hear the shooting. We were running. He says, we would eat this. Only in a rich country does this wildlife, you know, the pigeon or the rabbit isn't exactly wildlife. And I'd say, I would never eat a pigeon. And he'd say, because you don't know what it is not to eat for 4 days. You don't know what it is not to eat for 5-6 days at a crack. He says, you get hungry enough, you'll eat a pigeon. I says, you'll eat a pigeon, you'll eat a squirrel, you'll eat a rabbit. You'll do a lot of things. He says, that's because you live in a country where there's a grocery store. There's a Dominick's, there's a Jewel. We didn't have Dominick's and Jewel. We didn't have that in the run. So these are the things that came into my life as the result of amends. Quickly, I want to tell you about one more amends and then we'll break up for the day. When I was really, 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 really heavy, I had a hot tooth. I'm not a hot dude, but I had a hot tooth. A hot tooth is a tooth where the nerve is dying. And it either hurts like hell or you don't feel anything and you kind of hope it goes away. But I had a hot tooth, and I hadn't been to the dentist, hadn't brushed my teeth in years, hadn't been to the dentist. Hygiene was not high on my list. Besides, if I chew Wrigley Spearmint gum, it cleans your teeth, doesn't it? That's what it says on the package or something? I went to Dr. Richard Pipia on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago in California. Lincoln in California, Mather High School is over here. There's the car wash, and there's Dr. Pipia's office, or was, right? So, Lincoln in California, in West Rogers Park, I go to Dr. Pipia, and I'm sitting on his chair, and he says, I hope you don't break my chair. I just spent $2,500 fixing it. No more did he get that sentence out of his mouth than we heard a crack that came from the floor. I had broken his chair. I'm numb, and now I'm emotionally shut down because he is screaming at me for being so fat. He is screaming alternately at me and his daughter because he wants his daughter to make sure that she never takes another appointment from Harlan Grabowski ever again. and then I am never to come back to his office. How could you be so fat? Why do you eat so much? And he is screaming this at me over and over again. And I am just emotionally shut down. I do not know what to do. I don't know whether I should leave, whether I should stay. I cannot pay him for the chair. At this point in my life, I am broke. I don't know what the protocol is. I don't know anything. But he's finally yelling at his daughter enough so that she says, I got it, Dad. No more appointments for Harlan. I got his stuff right here. When he leaves, I will give him his file. He can take it with him. He comes back. He fixes my tooth. I had dental insurance through where I was working in radio. And I had a $65 copay on that office visit, and you know what he could do for the $65, pal. He never saw a dime. Well, now I'm in recovery, and now I've got to make amends, and now I'm going down my list of resentments, and I see Dr. Richard Pipia on the amends list. It goes. I have to pay him the $65. I kept pushing it back and pushing it back and pushing it back and pushing it back. Hell was going to freeze over before I was making amends to Pipia. The Cubs were going to win 10 World Series in a row before I'm doing that. Finally, push comes to shove, and I've got to go pay him the $65. I go to the office, and he is no longer on the door. There's no Richard Pipia on the door, but I see his daughter through the window, and I walk in, and I am there, and I went at that time from about, I was not 600 pounds, I might have been about 450, but I had lost 250 at that point. I come in there, and his daughter is there, and I find out that he died. I could walk out now and not make amends. He's dead. I give her the $65. I refresh her memory. She says she remembers me, and she apologized to me for his behavior. I paid her the $65. My tires did not touch the ground on the way home. I was square with the house. I had done the right thing. I could have not done it. He was an asshole. I mean, he was. He was abusive as hell to me. I had a peace and a serenity. Food was the last thing on my mind. There are going to be three byproducts of working the steps. You're going to be right with God. You're going to be right with yourself. And you're going to be right with your fellow human being. These amends will produce things unseen by us as humans, unknown to us as humans, unaware as we are of the abundance of the miracles of God. We don't know what God can do. That $65 has never brought anybody as much happiness as it brought me. I've had pleasure from food. I've had happiness from working the steps. We're going to talk about 10, 11, and 12 tomorrow morning. We're done for today.